This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Rachel Barton Pine has just released her 36th recording. It's also the first time she's recorded a big romantic concerto that was literally the first one she learned when she was about 8 years old. We'll also discover how she had intended on making this recording with the late Sir Neville Mariner, and you'll hear how Maude Powell has influenced everything Rachel has done in her career. Enjoy. Well, Rachel, tell me why you decided to pair the Elgar and the Brooke violin concertos together on the same recording.
Well, actually, it all goes back to an album that I loved during my student years. There was a reissue on CD of two of Menuhin's classic interpretations. When he was at the start of his career, he had recorded the Brooke and Elgar, not in the same year or with the same collaborators, and of course they would have originally been on 78 RPM records, but the CD reissue did put them together. And so they were sort of together in my mind because of that. And then, as I was out performing them and they both were on my wish list of things I wanted to record, I really felt like they would go together, first of all, kind of hilariously. Of the standard romantic concerti, the Brooke is pretty much the shortest and the Elgar is pretty much the longest. So that always had them live together in my mind for that reason. But more importantly, there's something very personal about each concerto. Whereas, you have your romantic concertos like Tchaikovsky that are full of angst, or you have, concertos that are very lofty, like the Brahms, which is about the majesty of creation. Like, somehow both the Brooke and Elgar are very human. They're intimate. They're passionate. There's a certain sound that I look for in each, which is very lush and rich and warm. And so even though they were written 40 years apart in different countries, I felt like somehow it worked to put them together. Interestingly, the Elgar is it's sort of a B-list concerto, not based on quality. In fact, the Dvorak violin concerto, for example, it's a wonderful concerto, but it's not the masterpiece that the cello concerto is. In the case of the Elgar, the cello concerto is shorter and more easily accessible, but it's not a superior work at all. In fact, one could argue the opposite. The violin concerto is truly a masterpiece and was one of Elgar's favorites among all of his own works. He even wanted one of the themes from the second movement to be engraved on his tombstone. So this is a fantastic piece, but because it's so long, it's hard to program, so audiences don't know it, because it doesn't get performed as often, because audiences don't know it, and you're kind of stuck in this rut. So I'm hoping that, albums like mine will help to familiarize people with it more, and I'll get to play it more frequently. But as I said, I didn't study it as a student, but luckily, when I was starting my career as a young adult, I was invited to play it pretty early on and learned it, and I've played it a handful of times over the years since then, and I always felt a very special affinity for it. The interesting thing is this was going to be Sir Neville Mariner's first recording of the Elgar. He was going to do this album with me. We had previously recorded the complete Mozart concertos together a few years ago, and we're planning to reunite for these two concertos. And when he was a young violinist, Sir Neville had studied the Elgar with his teacher, Billy Reed, the great London concertmaster, who had been the very violinist that Elgar consulted while writing the piece. So I got together with Sir Neville at his home in London, and he was telling me about, the stories that his teacher would tell about, working with Elgar, and it was so amazing. So we went through both scores, and then sadly, he passed away right before the session. And so I was like, oh no, what are we going to do? But thankfully, Andrew Litton was able to step in, and I'm so grateful, you know, that he did such a wonderful job, and it really worked out well.
I was really curious about the stories that Sir Neville Mariner was able to share with you, or what you learned from him having the opportunity to rehearse with him. Is there a little more specific story or something that you pulled from that experience that you can remember?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, first of all, the density of instructions that Elgar gives. You know, a lot of other composers leave it to the performer to come up with their own rubatos, you know, in other words, the pushing and pulling of the beat, which are what makes classical so different from much other music, which has, you know, kind of an almost metronomic steady beat. You know, we, of course, get to ebb and flow quite a lot, and the Brook is a good example of, you know, the very opening cadenza, a few bars into the concerto, the violinist has a statement unaccompanied, which is very, very free form, but Brook doesn't tell you exactly what to do with it for dynamic gradations or slow down, speed up, how to shape it. He leaves it to the individuality of the artist. Elgar, on the other hand, the music is extremely dense, with a little faster, a little slower, a little faster, a little slower, and it can feel quite discombobulating. And to be able to do all that he's asking you accurately is one thing, and then to internalize it to the point where it feels natural and really get inside the poetry of it. Sir Neville was definitely very helpful with that. And also just the fun stories, like Elgar would invite Billy Reed over to his house, and he would have different versions of the same passage taped on the walls and sitting on the backs of chairs and up on the mantelpiece. And Billy Reed would walk around the room trying all the different versions, and Elgar would be, you know, all excited and talk about with which option he liked best. And Billy Reed would suggest options that Elgar hadn't even thought of, and until they hit upon, you know, just the right one for each bit of the music. And so there are a lot of details in the music in terms of articulations, in terms of, you know, he even tells you what string you're supposed to be on sometimes, which is not always the obvious choice. And just knowing how carefully he thought all of this out, and that he tried so many different ways in order to hit upon this one, it makes you treat it with a lot of respect. And even if it's not the choice that you would naturally have made, you really try, you know, I think it's incumbent on the artist to try to do what Elgar asked, because Elgar really felt strongly about it and had a reason, you know, either, you know, just the sound that created, or the emotional content of what that string would do when singing in that particular moment. Yeah, that was very helpful to kind of know that history.
Well, and Elgar was a violinist, too, so he knew what the instrument was capable of. Does that sometimes make it a little more challenging?
Well, you know, there are definitely composers who write certain passages that are not idiomatic for the violin. You know, Prokofiev is a good example of that. Brahms, definitely, especially in the double concerto. Awkward as all get out. You're like, okay, this guy was obviously a pianist. But Elgar writes very idiomatically for the instrument, but that doesn't mean it's easy. I think he, you know, definitely wrote beyond his own personal skill level. He was not a virtuoso violinist composer who would have played his own piece. You know, so it all works, but some of it is very, very demanding. And I think it's actually one of the hardest concertos just to play the notes, not even getting into, you know, how difficult it is to make, you know, musical arc to the whole 50-minute extravaganza.
I did want to ask you about that because you noted like 89 technical spots that you would have to practice over and over and over again. I mean, that sounds crazy. First of all, how did you, you know, power through that? And then again, how did you eventually internalize it so that you could make this work your own and, you know, share the poetry?
Well, there are really no shortcuts. So a lot of it was just, you know, and every time I return to it for a concert, it's preparing it far enough in advance that you can just put in the sheer time. So, yeah, it's all about just doing it over and over and over again till it settles into your fingers and into your mind and into your heart. And at this point, you know, I think it'll, you know, every time you come back to something, it gets just a little easier. But yeah, this concerto is a big, big project, but so worth it. There are very interesting moments. Well, first of all, like Elgar has this mysterious dedication as he was wont to do. In this case, he says on the front page of the score, "Herein is enshrined the soul of dot, 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 dot." And so there's various speculation about which lady in his life he might have been implying and, you know, all of those, you know, scandals from 100 years. Well, I guess, you know, Elgar apparently was faithful in his marriage, but he nonetheless had deep emotional connections to various women along the way and very flowery correspondence and so on. So it's an interesting situation and, you know, just understanding where he was coming from about that. And there's actually an analysis of the first movement from just a couple years after it was premiered, where this musicologist wrote this very complicated theory of which themes were more masculine and which were more feminine in the, obviously, the understanding of those kinds of characteristics from the Victorian era, and then how they intertwined and so on, and almost as if the whole movement is a dialogue between a man and a woman. And he published this analysis, and Elgar did not dispute it, which is very telling, because had he disagreed, he would have said so. So the musicologist obviously kind of hit upon, you know, the secret. And then in the last movement, for example, just when you think the movement's about to end, both in terms of its construction and its length, you think, okay, we must be getting pretty close to the coda by now. Elgar veers off course, and he has an entire 5-minute cadenza, but it's not an unaccompanied cadenza. It's fully written out, and it's also accompanied by the orchestra, but it's a sort of a fantasy on themes from the entire concerto, and the accompaniment is very unique and fascinating, because he created this kind of strumming effect with the string players of the orchestra on their strings. In this plucky kind of way that it's amazing to think that there's, you know, could still be new things to discover about the potential of the violin after it has been with us in the world for, at that point, you know, 450 years. But nobody had ever thought to do that before him. And this effect was actually inspired by the wind chimes hanging over the door at his summer home. And so that's just an absolutely special, magical moment. You know, and to try to, you know, create an effective solo part to sing over that unique effect. Really, really interesting, and takes a lot of experimentation to find just the right colors. And it's just really, really magical.
You had mentioned that he wanted to have inscribed on his gravestone one of the themes from this second movement, and then there's a quote in there that is found on the final page. This is where two souls merge and melt into one another. Tell me a little bit more about that, because as you talked about how this may have been intended for another woman, that kind of makes one wonder.
Yeah, apparently he was never unaffectionate towards his wife. He cared deeply for his wife, and she kind of put up with these infatuations because they inspired his creativity and, You know, she liked it when he had successful compositions. I don't know. It's a weird situation. You can never get inside somebody else's relationship, truly. But yeah, sadly, he wasn't talking about his actual spouse when he made that statement. But it is absolutely tender and touching and so beautiful.
Do you know why Fritz Kreisler commissioned this work?
Kreisler had heard some of Elgar's other pieces and really admired Elgar as a composer and had talked about wouldn't it be great if Elgar wrote a violin concerto, and it seemed like such a logical thing to do anyway, because as you said, Elgar himself was a violinist, so why shouldn't he leave the world of violin concerto? So Kreisler was only given this music after it was finished. You know, it was Billy Reed who consulted with Elgar in its creation, which is not always the case. You know, often it's the dedicatee that goes back and forth with the composer or the commissioner. But in this case, Kreisler was handed the concerto ready to go. And he was definitely satisfied with the result, more than satisfied. In fact, he declared that this was the greatest of the violin concertos since Beethoven and Brahms. So he thought extremely highly of it. And, you know, even now from the perspective of, you know, a century hence, you know, I think it's a justifiable opinion. Like, you understand what he meant and where he was coming from. It is truly one of the great concertos. And yeah, so glad that Kreisler got Elgar to write it.
You learned that final movement to the Brook Concerto and performed it with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, is that right, when you were just 11?
Well, I learned the whole thing when I was 8, and I, you know, performed it with piano accompaniment and for competitions and so on. But the first time I played any of it with the orchestra was when I was 11, and I was invited to do a series of 8 youth concerts with the Chicago Symphony after I had made my debut with them the year before in a big concert, you know, with Eric Kleinsdorf doing the Saint-Saëns introduction, Rondo Capriccioso. So this was the following year, and yeah, I got to do the last movement, and I got to do it 8 times, so that was pretty awesome. I think I first played all 3 movements together with an orchestra in California when I was 14, and yeah, needless to say, I've played it countless times throughout my career, because it is one of the most popular concertos.
Now, is this the first time you've recorded it?
Yeah, well, there are very few pieces that I've recorded more than once. So, you know, and these days, you know, until recording technology significantly changes, that will probably be the case. You know, I recorded Brahms 15 years ago, but I don't know that I would be likely to ever record Brahms again in my lifetime, because I already recorded the Brahms, that kind of thing.
That's kind of why that was in my mind, because I thought, well, she's known this since she was 8, and it's been in her fingers since she was 8. So I was kind of surprised that, you know, you kind of just held off on recording it until now.
Well, it's not a question of holding off. It's like you can only do so many things per year. And, you know, there are so many things that I want to record. You know, I've been lucky to make 36 albums already, but there are, you know, 5 times that many projects that I hope to do in my lifetime. And I've recorded most of the major concerti so far, the Mendelssohn, Brook Scottish Fantasy, Beethoven, Brahms, Glazunov. I've done the Schumann. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Well, all the Mozarts, of course. So I've done a whole bunch of important ones, but there's a couple left. I haven't yet done Tchaikovsky. I plan to record that next year. I want to do Dvorak. I want to do Sibelius. So I've definitely got things still to look forward to, but hopefully I'll get it all done in my lifetime and get most of the things on my wish list in the can.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, too, this was, you know, just all came together with, you know, when you were hoping to work with Sir Neville Mariner and you wanted to pair it with the Elgar. So that makes sense. Is this number 36 then?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you, when you first started performing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, you started to, you know, eventually really develop some strong relationships and mentors. And I was wondering if you might talk about, you know, any of those folks in that orchestra who have inspired you.
Oh, well, what a great question. Gosh, my roots with the CSO are so deep, being a lifelong Chicagoan. Of course, I grew up back in the days when the unions would allow you to do such things and the television stations thought it was worth airing. They had weekly broadcasts on WGN television. So I would actually watch concerts of the Chicago Symphony on TV growing up on free television. And, of course, listen to their recordings on the radio. And, they were just kind of, knowing that they were one of the world's great orchestras in my own hometown orchestra was, very patriotically inspiring. It's kind of like, everybody that you look up to. And then I actually joined the training orchestra of the Chicago Symphony when I was 11. I was already being homeschooled at that time to accommodate my practice schedule. And so I had the luxury of time to be able to participate in that group. It's not a youth orchestra with the, weekly rehearsals of, teenagers. It's actually a training orchestra for college graduate and postgraduate students that rehearses multiple times a week. And I was able to join that ensemble when I was 11. And that was a wonderful opportunity to work with various CSO members as sectional coaches for chamber music, various groups that I was in with my civic orchestra colleagues. And then, of course, I started playing in the Chicago Symphony in my late teenage years for a short while as my solo career was getting up and running. And yeah, there's just so many people who've become friends. And a couple of the principals, actually, Joe Guastafessi, the principal bass, and Ray Still, the principal oboe, went to my church. And so we did some chamber music and worship when I was a little girl, which was an amazing experience. And I'm just so grateful for, to so many who were kind to me along the way and offered me, different thoughts and advice and encouragement. And yeah, it's meant a lot.
We're going to really be doing a lot to mark Women's History Month in March.
Ah.
And I wondered, Rachel, if you could identify maybe a female role model who's really inspired you and made a difference in your life. There's probably more than one, but if there's one or two that you'd identify, I would love to have you share those stories.
Well, that's a very easy question. My number one violin hero is Maud Powell. Maud Powell lived from 1867 to 1920, and she was the first American-born violinist to achieve international renown. And during her lifetime, she was considered to be the greatest American violinist of either gender, as well as the greatest woman violinist in the world. And she was not only a great artist, but also a groundbreaking artist. She was not only an interpreter of the great classics, but she also championed cutting-edge new music, modern pieces at the time, like the Sibelius and Dvorak and Tchaikovsky violin concertos, pieces that were considered so cutting-edge that audiences might not understand or enjoy them, but she insisted that these were great pieces and worthy of being heard, and she actually gave all of those concertos American premieres and championed them throughout the U.S. She also introduced countless new listeners to the violin. Instead of just playing normal concerts in big cities, on her day off in between, the big concerts, she would find some small town halfway in between and play that town's first ever classical concert, talking to the audience in between the selections about how to listen to the music, and basically doing what we now call outreach, a century before that that term was ever coined. She embraced the latest technology to help spread the music. She was a Victor Talking Machine Company's first instrumental recording star, for which she actually just received a Grammy a few years ago, a Lifetime Achievement Award, making her the fifth violinist, Heifetz, Perlman, Stern, and maybe Menuhin, and then her. And she was actually broke new ground even on that occasion, becoming the first female instrumentalist of any instrument, of any genre, to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys. She also championed not just European music, which was normal for American artists at the time, but music by American composers. She consciously sought out and deliberately incorporated the best of what she found into her recital programs. She also championed women composers like Amy Beach. She was the first white artist of any instrument to actively champion the music of black composers. So she was just an amazing, just the values by which she lived her life, in addition to her artistic legacy, really inspire everything I do, you know, whether it's playing music by minority composers or women composers, or doing all of my social media or outreach, or just, you know, all of my approach to programming, everything is just trying to do whatever I can to carry on Maude Powell's legacy.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. Next week, you'll have a chance to hear from Seraph Brass, an all-female brass ensemble, as we launch into Women's History Month. I'm Julia Mocker.